Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So here are two contrasting speech excerpts from this campaign season regarding racial inequality. First, Reverend William Barber, who will be on live as a guest in just a minute. He's the leader of North Carolina's NAACP. He's the civil rights correspondent for The Nation magazine and leader of the Moral Mondays movement, which has staged weekly events around voting rights and other issues. And if you tuned in early to watch Hillary Clinton's Democratic Convention speech, you may have seen Reverend Barber's 10-minute barn burner about an hour before the candidate. You might call it a political sermon.
Jesus, a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, called us to preach good news to the poor, the broken, and the bruised, and all those who were made to feel unaccepted.
Here's a longer excerpt, about a minute and a half, from a stretch that his magazine, The Nation, identified as the heart of the speech. We've edited out audience applause for time.
I say to you tonight that some issues are not left versus right or liberal versus conservative. They are right versus wrong. We need to embrace our deepest moral values and push for a revival of the heart of our democracy. When we fight to reinstate the power of the Voting Rights Act, and we break the interposition and nullification of the current Congress, we in the South especially know that when we do that, we are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we fight for 15 and a union, and universal health care, and public education, and immigrant rights, and LGBTQ rights, we are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we develop tax and trade policies that no longer funnel our prosperity to the wealthy few, we are reviving the heart of our democracy. When we hear the legitimate discontent of Black Lives Matter and we come together to renew justice in our criminal justice system, we are embracing our deepest moral values and reviving the heart of our democracy.
Reverend William Barber from his Democratic Convention speech. He'll join us live in just a minute. By contrast, Donald Trump in the last week has made some explicit appeals to Black voters and Latino voters for the first time in his campaign. Here is a minute of that from a speech he gave yesterday in Akron, Ohio.
Poor Hispanic and African American citizens are the first to lose a job or to see a pay cut when we don't control our borders. Hillary Clinton's plan amounts to total and absolute total open borders. Open borders. The Democrats have failed completely in the inner cities. Poverty, rejection, horrible education, no housing, no homes, no ownership, crime at levels that nobody's seen. You can go to war zones in countries that we're fighting, and it's safer than living in some of our inner cities. To the African Americans, who I employ so many people, to the Hispanics, tremendous people, what the hell do you have to lose? Give me a chance.
Donald Trump, again with applause and some booing, edited out for time, making a rare appeal to Black voters and Latino voters yesterday. With me now is Reverend William Barber, pastor of the Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina. His group, Repairers of the Breach, which is an Isaiah reference from the Bible, is holding a series of revivals around the country this summer. The next one will be in D.C. this Sunday. This is Reverend Barber's third appearance on this program. He was on in March to talk about voting in the North Carolina primary with the state's new voting restrictions, which have since been struck down in court. We'll talk about that. And he was a guest here on Martin Luther King's birthday this year to talk about his book called The Third Reconstruction. Reverend Barber, thanks for continuing the dialogue with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's good to be with you and your audience this morning.
You were already very prominent during your last two appearances, but at least I can say we had you twice before you became a rock star at the Democratic Convention. Can you talk about why you accepted that speech invitation, since I gather you rarely make political endorsements?
Very rarely. In fact, I think it's important to have a nonpartisan push that challenges all parties. You know, black people have had to do that throughout the history of this country. But when you have a candidate like Trump, you know, it would be something you could smile or laugh at if it wasn't so sinister and wasn't so cynical. And the week before, you remember, he stood up and engaged in a form of political idolatry when he said, "I and I alone could fix your problems." I've looked at George Wallace's 1968 speech when he used all the tactics of the white Southern strategy, and you see so much of that in what Trump is doing. It is very dangerous, I believe. It is not just Trump, it's Trumpism, because even with his tone, many in his party have still done the same thing. Remember, it's been McConnell and Ryan and Boehner in the Congress who've done everything they can to block President Obama's agenda to help lift America out of the greatest recession since the Depression. We've seen them block the Voting Rights Act fix for, you know, well over 1,000 days. And in state capitals around the country, like in North Carolina, we've seen, you know, legislators refuse to, you know, engage in voter suppression, refuse to tell the truth about voter fraud. And just recently, the courts said in North Carolina they engaged in intentional discrimination. And even after that, we have a executive director of the Republican Party telling boards of election not to follow the courts, in essence, but to do what the party wants done as it relates to voting. And so Trump represents not just himself, but this extremist mindset that is more about regression and going backwards. And I just felt, you know, after I prayed about it and talked to some advisors, a need to lift this moral call, you know, to the nation at that platform and say that we should embrace, you know, Ms. Clinton, not because any candidate is perfect, but because certainly we have on the polar opposite something that is very, very dangerous, I believe, to the heart of this nation.
Can I get your reaction to the argument that Trump was making in the speech excerpt from yesterday that we just played, maybe with your various hats on, but certainly with your North Carolina NAACP president hat on? He's making a point that after a generation of voting 90% for Democrats, Black America is still in the highly unequal state that it's in, and worse in some ways. And he says, what if people got to lose by taking a chance on a different political approach with Trump? What do you think about that new appeal?
Well, we have a lot to lose. You know, North Carolina, we've seen what happens when you elect extremism in our governor and legislature, and the way in which they have taken North Carolina back in so many ways: health care, public education, voting rights, immigrant rights, LGBTQ rights. But I want to say something to the media. He's not making an appeal to the black community, I don't think. I think that's the storyline with his new people, with Ailes and others want to get out. And it's a trick. It's an old trick. It's a method of deflection so that the Republican Party doesn't have to deal with its role in the continuance of systemic racism and classism that has hurt poor blacks and whites. It's as old as the strategy that Kevin Phillips designed with the Southern strategy, told Nixon, look, we can do this, but we've got to make the Democratic Party the party of black people, and we have to use these code words, as Lee Atwater later said, to pit blacks and whites against each other. So what he's really doing is he's saying to his white audiences, this party hasn't engaged in systemic racism. We don't have to deal with that. The real issue is blacks are their own problem. Now, he's making some assumptions. He's making some assumptions that nobody will call him out and say that the Republican extremists of today are not the Lincoln or even Teddy Roosevelt Republicans who supported voting rights, labor rights, ending slavery, providing health care for all, living wages, and public education. He's also betting that we don't know that since the 60s, And all the way through from Kevin Phillips to Robert Ailes, the modern party, Republican Party, sought, especially in the South and in the suburbs, to divide us by race. They've used coded race language like tax cuts, entitlements, retirement reform, states' rights, workers' rights, voters' fraud, in order to racialize and create a disdain for the very social programs that uplifted many whites in the 40s. And lastly, Brian, what he's really trying to do is hope that the American public forgets that the Republican Party today is the Dixiecrat parties of yesterday, and that they have been against voting rights protection, against ending voter suppression, against fully funding public education, against health care for all, against living wages, against labor rights, against immigrant rights. And his party has been a major blocker in doing the kinds of things that would, in fact, help deal with the issues of poverty in the African-American community. And, by the way, would actually be helping poor whites if they were implemented.
Reverend William Barber, our guest on WNYC. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. And I think we have a caller who wants to challenge you. So
Good. Let's
see what Cynthia in Houston has to say or ask. Cynthia, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian and Reverend Barber. Reverend Barber, I saw you on Washington Journal, and I was inspired by your comment. However, one listener asked a question that I didn't think you answered. He asked, what can we learn from Asians because they appear to prosper without many problems in their community? This is something I've been curious about. Would you answer that question directly?
Well, I think that is a very different dynamic, and I think when we say what can we learn, I don't agree with the premise of the question where we pit one against the other. The real issue is what can we learn from American history? What can we learn from the patterns of systemic racism, classism, and what can we learn in this particular season about how particularly, for instance, Donald Trump is trying to deflect and change the subject and trying to raise this issue. If you think about it, he's going to a 99% all-white audience talking about African-American people. He's leaving out so much history. He's trying to say, forget all of the things I've said, all of the policies that I've talked about that are rooted in racism and xenophobia, and somehow now, because I'm Trump on a teleprompter, you forget Trump and what I said when I was speaking from my heart and speaking from my own mindset. You know, American democracy is complicated. And anybody that attempts to dismiss systemic racism, systemic classism, the realities that we face, just does not understand the American process. In fact, I was reading this morning, Brian, a comment where it said the fact that most black people aren't poor, some 26% are, according to University of Michigan's National Poverty Center, and that's unacceptably high. But there are 10% of white Americans that are poor, and that 10% in actual numbers is larger than blacks and Hispanics.
Right.
Now, the question is, what causes whites to vote against their own self-interest and to really vote against many times candidates who stand against all of the kinds of social safety net and uplift program that would actually address poverty? That's
Although,
the question we need to ask.
To follow up on Cynthia's question and maybe take the comparison with Asians directly out of it, a lot of white America and maybe a lot of Asian America looks at black America and thinks many of the ongoing inequality issues are self-imposed 50 years after Jim Crow, 150 years after slavery, such a higher violent crime rate than other groups, not enough two-parent involvement, not enough academic achievement, and even in areas where Title I and other programs make the schools equally funded or more so per student. As a Baptist preacher with a largely black congregation and a growing national audience, there would be many white Americans who would ask, do you spend a lot of time on personal responsibility in addition to all the social responsibility aspects that you rightly talk about, as preachers often do both, or where do you find the right balance of that for our times?
Well, actually, I'm a Christian Church Disciples of Christ minister in a denomination that's predominantly white that is pro-reconciliation and pro-dealing with racial injustice, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think that there's this, you know, this is something, the Moral Monday movement, as you know, 50 to 60% of the people that got arrested were white. When we challenge the fact that our governor, on the one hand, and many others throughout the South who used this old Southern strategy, and you know, by 1969, using the Southern strategy, many whites believed that blacks were doing better than them and had received all of these free things and were the cause of their poverty. That's been the trick of the Southern strategy. But let me just say, yes, black people have always believed in personal responsibility. It's not something new, you know, that even in the days of segregation and Jim Crow, you know, African Americans taught their children to do the best you can, do twice as good. But that does not discount the fact of the fact that in this country, 60%, there's 64 million, for instance, Americans working that do not make a living wage, while we're paying corporate leaders 300 to 400 times more than the average worker. 54% of African Americans make less than a living wage. So you have somebody like a Trump or the extremists in the Republican Party saying, we want to deal with African American poverty as a matter of words, but then as a matter of policy, I'm against living wages. I'm against health care. I'm against fully funding public education. So, for instance, at our church, yes, we have after-school programs. We build homes for low and moderate income persons to own their own homes. We have a senior citizen complex. I do a drug dealer gangbanger redemption conference to bring people. But those efforts, that kind of personal charity and social service efforts cannot ever substitute the prophetic social justice effort that challenges the very system that continues to push and cause and the very problems that we're talking about. It's really counterintuitive for somebody like Trump and many Republicans to, on the one hand, say we love the poor and they talk about personal charity, but they never talk about public policy morality.
Sergey in Queens, you're on WNYC with Reverend William Barber. Hi, Sergey.
Good morning, Reverend, and forgive me for changing the topic, but since I've heard your speech at the convention, I wanted to know, what did you mean when you referred to Jesus as a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew? Because the Romans did not rename Judea Palestine until long after the crucifixion happened.
Well, actually, that's not correct. If you look in talk to biblical scholars, the word Palestine comes up long before the Romans. It comes up in biblical scholarship. It can be traced as far back as the days of the Philistines. But the fact of the matter is, I mean exactly what I said, that Jesus is a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew. We could even go further than that. We could say who was profiled by the government, who was killed by a state death penalty because he stood with the poor, he stood with the marginalized, he stood with those who Rome disdained and did not like. There's a great book by Philip Eastler called Luke and Acts and the context and history of Luke and Acts. He was killed on a cross because he was seen as an agitator. He was seen as someone who stood up for justice because, you know, crucifixion was reserved for those who took on the Roman government, who stood against the kind of religious ideology that catered more to the wealthy and the rich and the powerful and the oppressor rather than to the poor, the least of these, and those who were made to feel unacceptable. And so I meant exactly what I said, and it's so important to make that distinction when we talk about Jesus, I believe.
And we played that clip before, so some people have heard it for the first time in the last few minutes. It strikes me that you were making a common humanity point by referring to Jesus as a Palestinian Jew and putting those two descriptors back to back.
Exactly. And also, Brian, as you notice, I said that we are restoring the heart of this nation and maintaining our greatest values when we love the Jewish child and the Palestinian child, the Buddhist and the Hindu, the Muslim and the Christian, and even those who do not have faith but who love this country and who believe in the deep moral constructs of our Constitution. You know, that is who we are as America, but more importantly, who we are as should be as human beings. You know, one of the great challenges we have in this country, Brian, is that the so-called evangelical right, religious right, has so worked for years to reframe the moral discussion in this country. They did it, started it really, you know, after the rise of the social gospel movement in the early 1900s and the way it impacted the public policy of Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And people, many big business persons, if you read a book by Kevin Cruz called One Nation Under God, he really explores how there was this deliberate attempt to limit the moral conversation to things like prayer in the school, women's rights, and where you stand on homosexuality, which is so far away from the major thrust of moral discussions and justice discussion in the Bible. I'm a Christian, but even in the Old Testament, the Jewish part of the Bible, there are more than 2,000 scriptures in the entire Bible that deal with the issue of love, justice, mercy, how you treat the least of these, not just from a matter of personal charity, but from a matter of public policy. And it's amazing to me. And this is why our moral revival is challenging the so-called evangelical right. I don't like to use the term right when I think people are wrong, because it is a form of theological malpractice when you say so much about what the scriptures and our values say so little, and so little about what the scriptures say so much.
Lucy in Ossining, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lucy.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 50-year-old mom who raised three successful black children, and we can take something from the Asians because, honestly, Asians are succeeding. Whites are not. Whites can also take a lesson from the Asians, and the bottom line is education. And it does. And we know that there's systemic racism all throughout the country, and there will always be racism. But you can still succeed, and I think what it is it's hard work, it's education, and Asian students, they work hard and they continue to work hard, and a lot of white students and black students don't want to put in that hard work. And I was a teacher in a school district, and I see it from kindergarten. They don't have the same work ethic, and I think that's where the problem is.
Well, Brian, that's an interesting comment. My father had two master's degrees in the 1960s and working on his doctorate. My mother had a business degree, was trained as a major concert pianist. But in 1963, when I was born, they still didn't have protected voting rights or protected civil rights. You know, I graduated from North Carolina Central with honors, Duke with honors, a Dean's Scholar, Drew University. I've attended MIT. I have children that are all in college. One's a physicist, one's in law school, one's a PhD from Harvard, one's, you know, getting a double major. But all of them also.
But it's not about you, right? The caller's saying it's not about
you. Well, there's a lot about, you know, I think it can, but you know, that it's a misnomer. It's a misnomer to say it's like a pool table. If you tilt the pool table up on the end and say make the shot, somebody's going to make that shot. Somebody's going to be a trick pool type. But that's not how you're supposed to play pool. It's supposed to be level. And for me as a person of faith, faith says unto whom much is given, much is required. The reality is, the sister just talked about education. Let's talk about it. A report just came out that said over 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, poverty and resegregation is are the number one challenges in American schools. If a student is forced to go to a high-poverty, resegregated school where there's high teacher turnover, the course offerings are not there, you cannot then turn around and say if that child does not perform, it's because they did not work hard. Nor can you say if somebody makes it through that school that they worked hard and everybody else should do it. The fact is everybody shouldn't have to do it. So we cannot, on the one hand, lift up persons who have made it a certain way and then turn around and say the inequalities and the racism should just be ignored, the classism should just be ignored, the fact that parents don't have a living wage should just be ignored, and somehow people should just make it. We don't do that to corporations when they fail. When corporations fail, we bail them out with free money and say they're too big to fail. Well, if corporations are too big to fail, human beings and children and communities are too important, too made in the image of God to be told, just work hard.
Before you go, let me play one more short piece of your convention speech and ask you to talk about it. This is where you specifically refer to Isaiah and the name of your current group, Repairers of the Breach.
The prophet Isaiah cries out, "What I'm interested in seeing you doing, says the Lord, as a nation is, pay people what they deserve. Share your food with the hungry. Do this, and then your nation shall be called a repairer of the breach."
Can you just talk about that biblical concept, repairers of the breach?
Yeah. It's actually a concept that is in the Jewish tradition, and actually Jesus lifts it up in the Gospel of Luke when he talks about preaching good news to the poor. He's quoting from 58, 59, 16, 61 of Isaiah. But here's the concept, Brian. That admonition is the prophetic word. It's the prophet in the public square speaking directly to governments. King James says, loose the bands of wickedness. And in Hebrew, that can be translated, pay people what they deserve. And there's more in that litany. I had to abbreviate it.
Uh-huh.
But you've heard presidential candidates say, in America is a city sitting on a hill, or we shall be called the repairers of the breach. Well, Isaiah says, no, you're not a repairer of the breach. In other words, repairer of the separations that are caused by classism and racism and other isms, unless you deliberately turn your policies in a way, as a government, not individual charity, but the policies of the government that pay people what they deserve, lift up the poor, give people the health care. In other words, put the marginalized at the center of your public policy. And if you lift those at the bottom, guess what? Everybody benefits. You lift the whole society. And that's the only way in the sight of God's moral construct and righteousness construct can a nation be considered a repair of the breach. And if I use the language of our Constitution, that's the only way we can be a nation that establishes justice and provides for the common defense and promotes the general welfare. That's the challenge, and that's why we're having these revivals across the country. And that's why next week on the 29th, we're going to actually announce an action. I hope I can come back and talk about it in 25 state capitals on September the 12th. We need a revolution of moral values. We need to once again in the public square talk about economic sustainability, living wages, health care for all, public education, criminal justice reform, and equal protection under the law for everybody, women's rights, immigrant rights, and protecting voting rights, not just as political left-right issues, but as moral issues that are at the very heart and core of who we are or who we aren't as an American society.
Last question. Since you talk about the breach and you mentioned reconciliation before, use that word, we're going to be doing some programming here on the station next month around the idea of race, truth, and reconciliation in the United States. South Africa had its famous truth and reconciliation process after apartheid, and there are other examples, as you know, from around the world. I actually think it's more complicated here than it was in South Africa. But as someone who thinks about repairing the breach, do you think at all about racial reconciliation, a reconciling of history, and what that might look like?
All the time. In fact, that's why, for instance, one of the stories I can tell you in the Moral Monday movement is when I was invited to go out to a place called Mitchell County in North Carolina. That's 99% white, 89% Republican. It was after we had done 13 weeks of Moral Monday, and I was asked, most of the people out there are Republican and white. They invited us to come out, and we did, and we talked about, we got away from left versus right. That's why I think we can have more reconciliation if we get away from left and right and talk about what's moral and what's immoral, what I call constitutionally consistent, morally defensible, and economically sane. And we now organize in that county. We have a branch of the NAACP up there that's probably 95% white. Many of them are Republicans. But when we started looking at the issues of public education and health care and living wages and labor rights, they saw that the extremists who had said to them, elect me, I'll push prayer in the school, I'll be against abortion, I'll be against homosexuality, fed them those things as divisive terms and then went to the General Assembly and actually voted against their own self-interest in the mountains of North Carolina. One of my colleagues, and I hope we can come on together, Jonathan Wilson Hargrove, was a former staffer for Strom Thurmond, was fed the language and the litany of the white Southern strategy. We now work together. We work together in repairs of the breach, and we actually do a lot of training among persons who in some ways have told us they were brainwashed by the so-called religious right and have really begun to read the Bible afresh and really begun to reconsider and reanalyze moral perspectives afresh. So as a person of faith, one of the reasons, even though I may critique someone, I try to always speak in terms of love and justice and critique their policies as opposed to demeaning and diminishing and demonizing them as an individual, is because I have to believe. I'm commanded to have hope and commanded to believe that there is possibility for those who may be enemies to become friends.
Reverend William Barber's next Repairers of the Breach event will be this Sunday, August 28th at 6:30 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. I guess that's where I mistakenly got the impression that you're a Baptist.
Actually, 5 o'clock. Start at 5.
Oh, it's 5. Okay, yeah. I have it on your release as 6:30, so it's 5 o'clock Sunday
right.
in D.C. And so we know, no events or any events scheduled in the New York City area that you know of coming up?
I did something in Albany, and we're going to be doing something probably later. I'll make sure to let you know. And,
I'm
also now distinguished visiting professor
right.
of public theology and activism at Union Theological Seminary.
Oh.
So I'll be in and out of town and doing some things through seminary there.
Good.
Excited about that work.
Thank you so much for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend. God bless you and your audience.